David, psychologist in private practice, joining me in studio. Good morning.
Morning, Howard. Morning, Zanati.
So what do we do? How do we, you know, we're so uncomfortable talking about these things. We're so uncomfortable talking to our children about these things. We just want to pretend that they don't exist. And we all do that. And I guess it's natural to do that. But what do we do, David?
It's just, it's a very difficult topic to talk about. You know, when we think about young people, we want to think about,
the best times of your life.
Best time of your life.
The future ahead of you. Talented, beautiful, wonderful.
Absolutely. You know, and that's saying, you know, just enjoy your childhood because, you know, adulthood is when you have responsibility.
Yeah, youth wasted on the young. We get it, you know.
Absolutely. And I think it's just so hard and upsetting to think that our youth, and the statistics are telling us increasingly so, are having suicidal thoughts and are struggling, early on in life, which is very upsetting because it seems like it's not just the adults who are struggling.
So I guess to me, when I try and analyze it, there are two parts to this, or there are multiple parts, but there are two parts that I can think of that need to be explored. The first one is why it's happening. You know, when we talk to older people and in fact my wife was telling me yesterday, she was visiting a friend at Sandringham Gardens who she visits regularly, and she's an older person, not my wife, the friend, and she was saying that, you know, she doesn't ever remember this when she was younger. Now, does that mean it was just covered up? Or does it mean it genuinely didn't happen and something is going on with our children? So I guess the two parts that I think is, why is it happening, number one, and dealing with it, etc. And number two, how do we – well, number one is, why is it happening? And number two, how do we address it?
Well, I think, you know, if we talk about why is it happening, and there is, as I say, definitely an increase – the statistics in South Africa show us, in America, Canada, there's definitely an increase.
So there's no doubt.
And what's very interesting is that, you know, if we can call it that, that in the past, we've seen that males, young males, tend to have, if you want to, for want of a terrible word, successfully completed a suicide. But now we're seeing that young ladies are even though they attempted more suicides
in the past,
are actually, you know, again, terrible word, are actually, it's leading to a
death. Right, you don't want to use the word successful suicide, but,
yeah.
But in other words, are actualizing it.
Actualizing it. And it's,
okay, it's unequivocal, the numbers are up. We can't deny that.
We can't. And the reason why, you know, there's so much debate around it. And I think, you know, obviously the first, the first kind of element we jump on is social media. And we look at
the, well, it's so interesting you say that, because that we were having the discussion at our dinner table last night, and one of the first places we went was social media, and our kids got quite upset with it because, like, you know, it's so agenda driven. Everything is social media, and I actually think they're right. I don't believe it's all social
well,
media.
Well, I think we've got to be very careful just to put the blame or the cause onto one particular factor. I think, you know, while the research is saying social media plays a part, it is because people are, young teens are so much more exposed to, firstly to things that we as children weren't exposed to, things around, you know, when you think about firstly body image, how one should look, you know, they're bombarded with that. We had to really go find magazines and I think it was less prevalent then.
See, I don't agree.
I don't agree.
In fact, you know what? I was listening to our conversation as well as participating in it last night at home with our teenagers. Mm. And I actually thought to myself, you know, we did have that. Mm. We did want to be thin. We did want to be cool. We went to gym. I remember going to gym in Heilbron. Why did I go? I didn't love gym. I wanted to look cool. So we had it. I think the difference, and I'm going to go straight into it, and you'll tell me if you disagree with me, is I think that it's kind of where you're alluding to, but it's the pressure on our children.
Right.
When my child of 14 is saying that the teachers are, be immense pressure. They're under, and they say, look, we know we're pressurizing you, but you know, this is to prepare you for the pressure of matric. Mm-hmm. She's 14. What are we doing?
So to answer your question around social, you know, social media, I think when we were exposed to that, those kind of pressures. But I think it is magnified now because the amount of information that our teenagers are bombarded with is so much more. And also hearing about other people interacting when they excluded, hearing about other people's, if you want to call it, you know, really great lives, it does distort things. But you're right. It's not – we cannot just say it's one factor.
Well, I mean, that stress and pressure is multiple factors.
Multiple factors.
So it's coming from school. It's coming from the need to perform. It's coming from the pressure of everybody now knowing everything, which is back to social media.
Right. But also – this pressure of, I think, and again, you know, parents feel the pressure to give their children their best possible education.
So that, I think, is the other problem.
And parents, let's just start by saying parents are under a lot of stress, whether it's financial, emotional, physical. Mm. It's really hard out there. And it's, you know, children pick that up. But the second thing is that, you know, there is this anxiety around, you know, getting the best education, giving our children the best opportunities to be exposed to as many extramurals as possible, as many opportunities as possible. And I know we say this, and it starts, you know, what's upsetting, Howard, is that it starts to sound like a cliche, you know.
That's the problem.
It starts to sound, because
there's nothing so far that we've said in our 9 minutes that we've been talking about this, or 8 minutes, that is actually different to any of our other conversations.
Right. And that's the upsetting part, is that it is said over and over and over again, but we don't take it seriously enough. And it doesn't mean that every single young person who is exposed to social media and who is under huge pressure will attempt suicide.
No, not at all.
But there is a group of teens who
vulnerable
are more
kids.
Vulnerable, and that's what the issue is. And I think for me, as the pressure, as these factors kind of come more into play, we're finding that the greater vulnerable proportion of teens are now getting affected when in the past they weren't, because there wasn't these factors, you know, that we're talking about.
Although Kim says it, Kim Fine says it did happen in our day, Howard. I matriculated in 1983 and one guy in our class took his life during the matric year. So it did happen. There's no doubt that it happened. But we are seeing an incredible increase. I'd love your thoughts on 34519 or 061-895-1019. Sorry to bring this up, I don't understand. We also have to address homosexuality and our religion stance on it. I'm not sure if that is with a reference to suicide. Certainly, I would imagine that if a kid lives, let's say, within the Jewish community, and I would imagine a lot of communities, Christian communities, Muslim communities, and they recognize that they are gay, and that must be an added factor as well to consider. Please don't be sorry to bring it up. We have to bring these things up.
Yeah, we do. And in varsity, I had two friends, two gay friends that tried to commit suicide.
And is that because of social acceptance?
Yes.
Fear of non-social acceptance.
So, and I had a friend who would, in a space of 6 months, he kept on doing it over and over again because because of the fact that he came out and people just weren't accepting him and his family. And, you know, because of social norms, it's really, really just a sad, sad reality that some people are living through.
Absolutely. And there are risk factors. And please, I think we need to emphasize that if your child is experiencing one of them or two of them, doesn't mean necessarily that they are going to be suicidal. But
so I want to get to that in a bit. Mm-hmm. I don't want to get to how we recognize it and what we do about it yet. I want to leave that for the latter part of the conversation. I would like to try and understand what is happening in our environment that can cause this. Is it a possibility? And I'd love your thoughts, please. 34519 or 061-895-1019. It has to be that there are multiple factors. It can't be that there's only one factor. So I don't think we're going to find the only answer to this. But I believe that one of the factors might very well be as well that as parents today, we solve all of our kids' problems, or we certainly try to step in and solve all of our children's problems. Again, going back to when we were younger, and that's one of the points my kids raised when they were last night as well, was stop telling us how perfect things were. They weren't perfect. Mm. In fact, some of our, you know, we didn't have easy childhoods necessarily, but there were certain advantages of kind of being left alone. And being left alone meant sorting out your own issues and developing a certain amount of resilience. I mean, we were talking last night and my kids, we got onto the subject that sometimes it's very scary to be in your own thoughts. When we were younger, we had to be in our own thoughts because when you went to bed, you didn't have a cell phone, you didn't have a TV, you didn't have anything that, I mean, you had a book, but you could read as long as you could read. And then you were alone in your own thoughts. And my kids openly said, but that's quite scary. Mm. We're never alone in our own thoughts.
Well, I think that, you know, while we do kind of always point fingers at technology, it's because, and yes, teens would say to us, I feel so bad blaming teens. They were born into this, you know.
Of course.
But there was so much more room for real communication at our age. Why? Because we just didn't have the technology. And, you know, when you wanted to communicate, you didn't have your cell phone. So you tended to communicate with people around you.
Mm.
And those tend to be people who your caregivers, mom, dad, friends. And so again, we had more room to express ourselves, more opportunities to express ourselves to people who are really in touch with us, you know. So if you, and what I mean by that is if you're communicating with a friend on Facebook or on social media, it's not the same. And often we don't speak about
our feelings. So in many ways, David, whether we like it or not, we are coming back to social media.
Mm-hmm. I think we are.
And not necessarily in terms of social media itself, but everything it represents.
And I think just epitomizes where we are as a society, that yes, there is communication and we can say that friends do communicate and friendships are strengthened or occur over social media. But when it comes to this degree of distress, it's not so simple to pick it up often. It's not so – it doesn't just glare at you. And I think for me those nuances are picked up when you are communicating with that person face-to-face, when you're interacting with that person on a regular basis.
An emoji is not body language.
No, not at all. You know, no. How often do we send out a sad emoji?
Mm.
How often do we say, oh, not feeling great today?
Mm.
You know, that really doesn't mean a lot to people.
What about resilience?
You know, I think for me what we need to say is yes, absolutely. Our teens, our children are under a lot more pressure. But again, I think we also need to point out that when it comes to like resilience, when we talk about resilience, you know, it's about overcoming difficult times and our kids do it. I mean, the majority of our kids, when we talk about all these difficult, factors that they face, whether it's pressure at school, social media, cyberbullying, whatever it might be, a huge majority of them do not think about suicide or certainly don't attempt suicide. But what is important to point out is that, you know, whether you have resilience or not, if you have a predisposition to a vulnerability, a genetic predisposition to something like depression, then you are more likely, no matter how much resilience you have, to struggle with your mood and often then with feelings of thoughts of suicide.
Mm, mm.
So I think we've got to be very careful to say, oh, you know, a person who thinks of suicide, who commits suicide has got very little resilience. There are so many factors that are at play there. And, you know, when we do talk about the factors, I think it's important. You'll see that there are serious things that impact on people's lives, that cause people to feel, suicidal. So to blame resilience, to say that we're not, making our children resilient, children aren't resilient today, I think we've got to be very careful to jump to that conclusion.
All right. Here's a very interesting SMS. Good morning, Howard. Such a typical, hard conversation, this. I have three teens and they say there is exceptional pressure to be in, and some parents are not allowing children to speak openly to parents about their stuff. As a mother, I see parents and myself included with a very little skills to deal with the pressures that our children are facing. Living in the moment, limiting our time with our children, and not giving children a safe space to express. Sorry, David, repeated trips to therapy is exceptionally expensive, and some kids resist outside help. This is a huge issue. I wish I had the answers. God bless Bendita.
And I think she's making
a brilliant point.
Brilliant point. And I think for me, you know, when we look at all the research and we look at the best preventions, you know, that actually what comes out is about empowering. Obviously, we want to empower, you know, the young people. Mm. But actually, what's more important is to not only just be like sending your child to therapy and to, but about parents empowering themselves. Parents
having the courage. I think that today, often as parents, there's almost this generation gap that's kind of happened. It's like our grandparents to our parents, when they might have come to South Africa from Europe, and you know that was the old life, and now there's a new life. We're almost in a technology old life and new life, and that makes. That creates a much bigger generation gap between us and our children. And what that means is we often don't have the courage to say to our children, you're actually not going to bed with your cell phone, even if, because they're teenagers and we don't know. Well, maybe that's how everybody's doing it. And, you know, we question our own instinct and knowledge and confidence as a parent because we don't get the world that our children are living in.
Absolutely. I can't agree with you more, Howard, that we don't trust our instincts as parents, because again, we are the most out of touch parents in the history of the world, I would say, because as far as technology is concerned, things are moving so quickly, we just can't keep up. But with exactly as you say, we lose that trust in our gut, and we need to trust that gut, and we need to set limits for our children, and we don't have to be so afraid. And I think it refers to what we were talking about before, where we're so worried that if we restrict our children's time on social media, that somehow we are restricting their, you know, their potential and their ability to socialize, and so we'll cut them off from their friends, and they won't be popular, or they won't have friends. Or that we are like restricting their access to knowledge and somehow going to, you know, retard their ability to be successful in the world. I think we're too afraid of our children, and we need to really, not be, because they are still children, even if they seem so sophisticated. And so importantly, I think then just to trust your gut. Very importantly, what you also said, Howard, is that it is a very scary thing to speak about, to actually speak about, if you want to call it the elephant in the room. It's so important, you know, and we can go through the symptoms and the signs and the risk factors, that if your gut is telling you that your child is having difficulty, is depressed, is not feeling themselves, it's very important that parents address it with them in a kind and sensitive, non-judgmental way.
All right. When we come back, I want to talk about how we recognize what are the signs, what we need to look for, and perhaps how to deal with it. It's 8:30. It is 8:33. I'm Howard Feldman. This is your Morning Mayhem, 101.9 High FM. We're having the extremely difficult and extremely uncomfortable conversation around teenage suicide. The incredible increase, an event that took place yesterday, an incident that took place yesterday. It is absolutely imperative that we talk about this, whether we want to or not. David, how do we recognize, David Abramson, psychologist in private practice, joining me in studio, how do we recognize if our children are at risk?
Well, I think we need to look at a couple of factors. And the first one is when we talk about risk factors, like experiences or situations that a child, a teen is going through. And again, I just need to really, Howard, I want to put this point across very clearly, that if your child or teen has experienced one of these, or even two or few of these events, it doesn't necessarily mean that they are going to take their lives. I think for me, these are just risk factors that have been identified. And these
Before you tell us the risk factors, are there risk ages?
What you mean, particular
you know,
risk
is
ages?
From what age do we need to start taking this seriously? Is a 10-year-old at risk, or versus a 15 versus a 19?
Yeah, I think for me, unfortunately, to say, you know, there have been situations where 10-year-olds have been.
Wow.
It's
not the answer I was expecting.
Yeah, 10-year-olds do have suicidal ideation. But I think the risk factors are, and very importantly, if there is, a history of psychiatric illnesses in the family, and very importantly, that 90% of people who have suicidal thoughts, or teens who have suicidal thoughts, have depression. So I think that's very important to point out. Also, if there's been, terrible experiences like sexual abuse or physical abuse, for example, there's been some, traumas in their lives, like losses of very, very losses of people who are close to them, severe physical illnesses, been through a traumatic event, and exactly as you were saying earlier, often dealing with sexual orientation, really just struggling with the idea of who am I, and who am I going to become, and these are very, very difficult existential crises for and also relationships. We often say to ourselves, when teens break up with a girlfriend or have a tiff with a friend, we tend to belittle it.
They're kids. But tomorrow it'll pass.
It'll pass, and they're not married, and this is their first relationship. Mm. We need to watch those things very carefully. But when it comes to the actual physical warning signs, I think the things that we need to look out for is, if a child or teen has this preoccupation with death, is, drawing self-destructive, things, is writing assignments with themes around death. You also notice that, your child is changed. There's this intense sadness or hopelessness about, the way they are. They're not doing or caring about activities that they used to care about in the past. Social withdrawal, just wanting to spend time on their own. Substance abuse is often a sign. Sleep disturbances, so they are not sleeping as much, or they are sleeping way more than normal. Very importantly, giving away possessions. It's something that we need to watch carefully. Why suddenly my child giving away things that
mean something to him,
or of value? Mm. We look at lack of energy, concentration is a problem. Also, decline in school performance and increased absence from school. Just this general lack of
interest
in the world, and also changes in appetite, and often, and you'll say all adolescents are that, but increased irritability. But it's important to go.
Yeah, but as parents, you know what's within their normal range.
Yes, because people might be rolling their eyes and saying, this is every teenager.
Yeah.
But I think for me, we're talking about extremes. We're not talking about, this is teenage moods. This is, teenage irritability. And the important thing is to say, Howard, that if as a parent, and you're right, I think you're the listener who SMS'd in to say, yes, absolutely. Sometimes, going to a therapist is not affordable, but there are so many, places to call who can support you and give you guidance. So, and obviously we can talk about those and give out those numbers, because it doesn't necessarily mean you have to go to a private therapist or social worker to get assistance. Mm. So it's important for parents to know, if they're in doubt, if they are worried, the first step would really be about confronting your child in a non-judgmental way. I'm worried about you. I've noticed certain things. And to say it directly, have you thought of hurting yourself? Have you thought of doing something to yourself? And then the next step, have you actually got a plan? Have you thought about a plan? Because that would show that they've had even advanced thoughts, advanced planning about things. But if it's worrying you, as I say, you're not alone. There are places, and people that you can talk to.
Bendita says, me again, schools are completely unequipped to allow for teenage development. Children need academic, vocational, and emotional education.
Absolutely. Such a valuable point, that we're so worried about generally about educating our children from an intellectual level.
But we don't actually equip them
for life.
Well, that's a big concern of mine. And Shulamit says, morning, to get time with my son before we read books before bedtime, I switch off the lights, we lie in the dark, and we talk about his day, his fears, his stuff. And I must say it works with us. I'm in touch with his feelings and fears and what makes him happy. And yes, I still read a bedtime novel to my 12-year-old.
Fantastic.
Technology is so part of their lives, so the only way to be part of his life is to read to him.
I think that's fantastic. And some children aren't as communicative. They don't have that you know, that emotional vocabulary. And right. you could even use numbers. You say, how was your day? And the child grunts at you, or, you know, fine. How was it 1 to 10? That's all I want to know. 1 to 10.
And then you get a measure. Then you get a matrix.
And it's actually very accurate often, because you can actually get a, you know, in words sometimes it gets a bit vague. It can get lost in translation. Yeah, if you say my day was 3 out of 10, that's not very good. If my day was 5 out of 10, okay, half off. So, you know, 7 out of 10, okay, we're not perfect, but doing well. So I think even if you get anything, if, you know, out of your child, and your child isn't as verbal, no matter at what age, then you can use that matrix as well.
All right, the time is 8:40. This is very, very important. It's a very, very important conversation. Michiel says, I think that the school can identify the problems, but at the end it's the parents' responsibility to talk to their children. I happen to agree. And Janine says, 25 years ago, a work colleague lost his 11-year-old son to suicide, something that will never leave me. And there you go, talking about the age. I would have assumed that it was really only older teenagers who were at risk.